1960s, and those who embraced the purely mechanical version of the Tao theory some 20 years earlier. In both cases, the advent of popularity marked almost the exact moment when the system ceased to work well. We have had a like discomforting experience with our own central value method of determining indicated buying and selling levels of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. The moral seems to be that any approach to money-making in the stock market, which can be easily described and followed by a lot of people, is by its terms too simple and too easy to last. Spinoza's concluding remark applies to Wall Street as well as to philosophy. All things excellent are as difficult as they are rare. Market fluctuations of the investor's portfolio. Every investor who owns common stocks must expect to see them fluctuate in value over the years. The behavior of the DJIA since our last edition was written in 1964 probably reflects pretty well what has happened to the stock portfolio of a conservative investor, who limited his stock holdings to those of large, prominent, and conservatively financed corporations. The overall value advanced from an average level of about 890 to a high of 995 in 1966, and 985 again in 1968, fell to 631 in 1970, and made an almost full recovery to 940 in early 1971. Since the individual issues set their high and low marks at different times, the fluctuations in the Dow Jones group as a whole are less severe than those in the separate components. We have traced through the price fluctuations of other types of diversified and conservative common stock portfolios, and we find that the overall results are not likely to be markedly different from what stated before. In general, the shares of second-line companies fluctuate more widely than the major ones, but this does not necessarily mean that a group of well-established but smaller companies will make a poorer showing over a fairly long period. In any case, the investor may as well resign himself in advance to the probability, rather than the mere possibility, that most of his holdings will advance, say, 50% or more from their low point, and decline the equivalent one-third or more from their high point at various periods in the next 5 years. A serious investor is not likely to believe that the day-to-day or even month-to-month fluctuations of the stock market make him richer or poorer. But what about the longer-term and wider changes? Here, practical questions present themselves, and the psychological problems are likely to grow complicated. A substantial rise in the market is at once a legitimate reason for satisfaction and a cause for prudent concern, but it may also bring a strong temptation toward imprudent action. Your shares have advanced. Good. You are richer than you were. Good. But has the price risen too high? And should you think of selling? Or should you kick yourself for not having bought more shares when the level was lower? Or, worst thought of all, should you now give way to the bull market atmosphere, become infected with the enthusiasm, the overconfidence, and the greed of the great public, of which, after all, you are a part, and make larger and dangerous commitments? Presented thus, the answer to that last question is a self-evident no. But even the intelligent investor is likely to need considerable willpower to keep from following the crowd. It is for these reasons of human nature, even more than by calculation of financial gain or loss, that we favor some kind of mechanical method for varying the proportion of bonds to stocks in the investor's portfolio. The chief advantage, perhaps, is that such a formula will give him something to do. As the market advances, he will, from time to time, make sales out of his stock holdings, putting the proceeds into bonds. As it declines, he will reverse the procedure. These activities will provide some outlet for his otherwise too pent-up energies. If he is the right kind of investor, he will take added satisfaction from the thought that his operations are exactly opposite from those of the crowd. Business valuations versus stock market valuations. The impact of market fluctuations upon the investor's true situation may be considered also from the standpoint of the shareholder as the part owner of various businesses. The holder of marketable shares actually has a double status, and with it the privilege of taking advantage of either at his choice. On the one hand, his position is analogous to that of a minority shareholder or silent partner in a private business. Here his results are entirely dependent on the profits of the enterprise, or on a change in the underlying value of its assets. He would usually determine the value of such a private business interest by calculating his share of the net worth, as shown in the most recent balance sheet. On the other hand, the common stock investor holds a piece of paper, an engraved stock certificate, which can be sold in a matter of minutes at a price which varies from moment to moment, when the market is open, that is, and often is far removed from the balance sheet value. The development of the stock market in recent decades has made the typical investor more dependent on the course of price quotations and less free than formerly to consider himself merely a business owner. The reason is that the successful enterprises in which he is likely to concentrate his holdings sell almost constantly at prices well above their net asset value, or book value, or balance sheet value. In paying these market premiums, the investor gives precious hostages to fortune, for he must depend on the stock market itself to validate his commitments. This is a factor of prime importance in present-day investing, and it has received less attention than it deserves. The whole structure of stock market quotations contains a built-in contradiction. The better a company's record and prospects, the less relationship the price of its shares will have to their book value. But the greater the premium above book value, the less certain the basis of determining its intrinsic value. For example, the more this value will depend on the changing moods and measurements of the stock market. Thus we reach the final paradox, that the more successful the company, the greater are likely to be the fluctuations in the price of its shares. This really means that, in a very real sense, the better quality of a common stock, the more speculative it is likely to be, at least as compared with the unspectacular middle-grade issues. What we've said applies to a comparison of the leading growth companies with the bulk of well-established concerns. We exclude from our purview here those issues which are highly speculative because the business themselves are speculative. The argument just made should explain the often erratic price behavior of our most successful and impressive enterprises. Our favorite example is the monarch of them all, International Business Machines. The price of its shares fell from 607 to 300 in 7 months in 1962 through 63. After two splits, its price fell from 387 to 219 in 1970. Similarly, Xerox, an even more impressive earnings gainer in recent decades, fell from 171 to 87 in 1962 through 63, and from 116 to 65 in 1970. These striking losses did not indicate any doubt about the future long-term growth of IBM or Xerox. They reflected instead a lack of confidence in the premium valuation that the stock market itself had placed on these excellent prospects. The previous discussion leads us to a conclusion of practical importance to the conservative investor in common stocks. If he is to pay some special attention to the selection of his portfolio, it might be best for him to concentrate on issues selling at a reasonably close approximation to their tangible asset value, say at not more than one-third above that figure. Purchases made at such levels, or lower, may, with logic, be regarded as related to the company's balance sheet, and as having a justification or support independent of the fluctuating market prices. The premium over book value that may be involved can be considered as a kind of extra fee paid for the advantage of stock exchange listing and the marketability that goes with it. A caution is needed here. A stock does not become a sound investment merely because it can be bought at close to its asset value. The investor should demand, in addition, a satisfactory ratio of earnings to price, a sufficiently strong financial position, and the prospect that its earnings will at least be maintained over the years. This may appear like demanding a lot from a modestly priced stock, but the prescription is not hard to fill under all but dangerously high market conditions. Once the investor is willing to forego brilliant prospects, for example, better than average expected growth, he will have no difficulty in finding a wide selection of issues meeting these criteria. In our chapters on the selection of common stocks, chapters 14 and 15, we shall give data showing that more than half of the DJIA issues met our asset value criterion at the end of 1970. The most widely held investment of all, American Tel-N-Tel, actually sells below its tangible asset value as we write. Most of the Light and Power shares, in addition to their other advantages, are now, early 1972, available at prices reasonably close to their asset values. The investor with a stock portfolio having such book values behind it can take a much more independent and detached view of stock market fluctuations than those who have paid high multipliers of both earnings and tangible assets. As long as the earning power of his holdings remains satisfactory, he can give as little attention as he pleases to the vagaries of the stock market. More than that, at times he can use these vagaries to play the master game of buying low and selling high. The A&P example. At this point, we shall introduce one of our original examples, which dates back many years, but which has a certain fascination for us, because it combines so many aspects of corporate and investment experience. It involves the Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company. Here is the story. A&P shares were introduced to trading on the CURB market, now the American Stock Exchange, in 1929, and sold as high as 494. By 1932, they had declined to 104, although the company's earnings were nearly as large in that generally catastrophic year as previously. In 1936, the range was between 111 and 131. Then, in the business recession and bear market of 1938, the shares fell to a new low of 36. That price was extraordinary. It meant that the preferred and common were together selling for $126 million, although the company had just reported that it held $85 million in cash alone and a working capital or net current assets of $134 million. A&P was the largest retail enterprise in America, if not in the world, with a continuous and impressive record of large earnings for many years. Yet in 1938, this outstanding business was considered on Wall Street to be worth less than its current assets alone, which means less as a going concern than if it were liquidated. Why? First, because there were threats of special taxes on chain stores. Second, because net profits had fallen off in the previous year, and third, because the general market was depressed. The first of these reasons was an exaggerated and eventually groundless fear. The other two were typical of temporary influences. Let us assume that the investor had bought A&P Common in 1937 at, say, 12 times its five-year average earnings, or about 80. We are far from asserting that the ensuing decline to 36 was of no importance to him. He would have been well advised to scrutinize the picture with some care, to see whether he had made any miscalculations. But if the results of his study were reassuring, as they should have been, he was entitled then to disregard the market decline as a temporary vagary of finance, unless he had the funds and the courage to take advantage of it by buying more on the bargain basis offered. Sequel and reflections. The following year, 1939, A&P shares advanced to 117.5, or three times the low price of 1938, and well above the average of 1937. Such a turnabout in the behavior of common stocks is by no means uncommon, but in the case of A&P, it was more striking than most. In the years after 1949, the grocery chain shares rose with the general market, until in 1961, the split-up stock, 10-for-1, reached a high of 70.5, which was equivalent to 705 for the 1938 shares. This price of 70.5 was remarkable for the fact that it was 30 times the earnings of 1961. Such a price over earnings ratio, which compares with 23 times for the DJIA in that year, must have implied expectations of a brilliant growth in earnings. This optimism had no justification in the company's earnings record in the preceding years, and it proved completely wrong. Instead of advancing rapidly, the course of earnings in the ensuing period was generally downward. The year after the 70.5 high, the price fell by more than half to 34. But this time the shares did not have the bargain quality that they showed at the low quotation in 1938. After varying sorts of fluctuations, the price fell to another low of 21.5 in 1970 and 18 in 1972, having reported the first quarterly deficit in its history. We see in this history how wide can be the vicissitudes of a major American enterprise in little more than a single generation, and also with what miscalculations and excesses of optimism and pessimism the public has valued its shares. In 1938, the business was really being given away, with no takers. In 1961, the public was clamoring for the shares at a ridiculously high price. After that came a quick loss of half the market value, and some years later, a substantial further decline. In the meantime, the company was to turn from an outstanding to a mediocre earnings performer. Its profit in the boom year 1968 was to be less than in 1958. It had paid a series of confusing small stock dividends, not warranted by the current additions to surplus, and so forth. A&P was a larger company in 1961 and 1972 than in 1938, but not as well run, not as profitable, and not as attractive. There are two chief morals to this story. The first is that the stock market often goes far wrong, and sometimes an alert and courageous investor can take advantage of its patent errors. The other is that most businesses change in character and quality over the years, sometimes for the better, perhaps more often for the worse. The investor need not watch his company's performance like a hawk, but he should give it a good hard look from time to time. Let us return to our comparison between the holder of marketable shares and the man with an interest in a private business. We have said that the former has the option of considering himself merely as the part owner of the various businesses he has invested in, or as the holder of shares which are saleable at any time he wishes, at their quoted market price. But note this important fact. The true investor scarcely ever is forced to sell his shares, and at all other times he is free to disregard the current price quotation. He need pay attention to it and act upon it only to the extent that it suits his book, and no more. Thus, the investor who permits himself to be stampeded or unduly worried by unjustified market declines in his holdings is perversely transforming his basic advantage into a basic disadvantage. That man would be better off if his stocks had no market quotation at all, for he would then be spared the mental anguish caused him by other persons' mistakes of judgment. Incidentally, a widespread situation of this kind actually existed during the Dark Depression days of 1931 through 1933. There was then a psychological advantage in owning business interests that had no quoted market. For example, people who owned first mortgages on real estate that continued to pay interest were able to tell themselves that their investments had kept their full value, there being no market quotations to indicate otherwise. On the other hand, many listed corporation bonds of even better quality and greater underlying strength suffered severe shrinkages in their market quotations, thus making their owners believe they were growing distinctly poorer. In reality, the owners were better off with the listed securities, despite the low prices of these. For if they had wanted to, or were compelled to, they could at least have sold the issues, possibly to exchange them for even better bargains. Or they could just as logically have ignored the market's action as temporary and basically meaningless. But it is self-deception to tell yourself that you have suffered no shrinkage in value merely because your securities have no quoted market at all. Returning to our A&P shareholder in 1938, we assert that as long as he held on to his shares, he suffered no loss in their price decline, beyond what his own judgment may have told him was occasioned by a shrinkage in their underlying or intrinsic value. If no such shrinkage had occurred, he had a right to expect that in due course the market quotation would return to the 1937 level, or better, as in fact it did the following year. In this respect, his position was at least as good as if he had owned an interest in a private business with no quoted market for its shares. For in that case, too, he might or might not have been justified in mentally lopping off part of the cost of his holdings because of the impact of the 1938 recession, depending on what had happened to his company. Critics of the value approach to stock investment argue that listed common stocks cannot properly be regarded or appraised in the same way as interest in similar private enterprise, because the presence of an organized security market injects into equity ownership the new and extremely important attribute of liquidity. But what this liquidity really means is, first, that the investor has the benefit of the stock market's daily and changing appraisal of his holdings, for whatever that appraisal may be worth. And second, that the investor is able to increase or decrease his investment at the market's daily figure, if he chooses. Thus, the existence of a quoted market gives the investor certain options that he does not have if his security is unquoted. But it does not impose the current quotation on an investor who prefers to take his idea of value from some other source. Let us close this section with something in the nature of a parable. Imagine that in some private business you own a small share that cost you $1,000. One of your partners, named Mr. Market, is very obliging indeed. Every day he tells you what he thinks your interest is worth, and furthermore offers either to buy you out or to sell you an additional interest on that basis. Sometimes his idea of value appears plausible and justified by business developments and prospects as you know them. Often, on the other hand, Mr. Market lets his enthusiasm or his fears run away with him, and the value he proposes seems to you a little short of silly. If you are a prudent investor or a sensible businessman, will you let Mr. Market's daily communication determine your view of the value of a $1,000 interest in the enterprise? Only in case you agree with him, or in case you want to trade with him. You may be happy to sell out to him when he quotes you a ridiculously high price, and equally happy to buy from him when his price is low. But the rest of the time, you will be wiser to form your own ideas of the value of your holdings, based on full reports from the company about its operations and financial position. The true investor is in that very position when he owns a listed common stock. He can take advantage of the daily market price, or leave it alone, as dictated by his own judgment and inclination. He must take cognizance of important price movements, for otherwise his judgment will have nothing to work on. Conceivably, they may give him a warning signal, which he will do well to heed. This, in plain English, means that he is to sell his shares because the price has gone down, foreboding worse things to come. In our view, such signals are misleading, at least as often as they are helpful. Basically, price fluctuations have only one significant meaning for the true investor. They provide him with an opportunity to buy wisely when prices fall sharply, and to sell wisely when they advance a great deal. At other times, he will do better if he forgets about the stock market and pays attention to his dividend returns and to the operating results of his companies. Summary. The most realistic distinction between the investor and the speculator is found in their attitude toward stock market movements. The speculator's primary interest lies in anticipating and profiting from market fluctuations. The investor's primary interest lies in acquiring and holding suitable securities at suitable prices. Market movements are important to him in a practical sense because they alternately create low price levels at which he would be wise to buy and high price levels at which he certainly should refrain from buying and probably would be wise to sell. It is far from certain that the typical investor should regularly hold off buying until low market levels appear, because this may involve a long wait, very likely the loss of income, and the possible missing of investment opportunities. On the whole, it may be better for the investor to do his stock buying whenever he has money to put in stocks, except when the general market level is much higher than can be justified by well-established standards of value. If he wants to be shrewd, he can look for the ever-present bargain opportunities in individual securities. Aside from forecasting the movements of the general market, much effort and ability are directed on Wall Street towards selecting stocks or industrial groups that in matter of price will do better than the rest over a fairly short period in the future. Logical as this endeavor may seem, we do not believe it is suited to the needs or temperament of the true investor, particularly since he would be competing with a large number of stock market traders and first-class financial analysts who are trying to do the same thing. As in all other activities that emphasize price movements first and underlying values second, the work of many intelligent minds constantly engaged in this field tends to be self-neutralizing and self-defeating over the years. The investor with a portfolio of sound stocks should expect their prices to fluctuate and should neither be concerned by sizable declines nor become excited by sizable advances. He should always remember that market quotations are there for his convenience, either to be taken advantage of or to be ignored. He should never buy a stock because it has gone up, or sell one because it has gone down. He would not be far wrong if this motto read more simply, "Never buy a stock immediately after a substantial rise, or sell one immediately after a substantial drop." An added consideration. Something should be said about the significance of average market prices as a measure of managerial competence. The shareholder judges whether his own investment has been successful in terms both of dividends received and of the long-range trend of the average market value. The same criteria should logically be applied in testing the effectiveness of a company's management and the soundness of its attitude toward the owners of the business. This statement may sound like a truism, but it needs to be emphasized. For as yet, there is no accepted technique or approach by which management is brought to the bar of market opinion. On the contrary, managements have always insisted that they have no responsibility of any kind for what happens to the market value of their shares. It is true, of course, that they are not accountable for those fluctuations in price, which, as we have been insisting, bear no relationship to underlying conditions and values. But it is only the lack of alertness and intelligence among the rank and file of shareholders that permits this immunity to extend to the entire realm of market quotations, including the permanent establishment of a depreciated and unsatisfactory price level. Good managements produce a good average market price, and bad managements produce bad market prices. Fluctuations in bond prices. The investor should be aware that even though safety of its principal and interest may be unquestioned, a long-term bond could vary widely in market price in response to changes in interest rates. If you take a look at Table 8.1 on the enhancement, we give data for various years back to 1902, covering yields for high-grade corporate and tax-free issues. As individual illustrations, we add the price fluctuations of two representative railroad issues for a similar period. These are the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe General Mortgage 4S, due 1995, for generations one of our premier non-callable bond issues, and the Northern Pacific Railroad 3s, due 2047, originally a 150-year maturity, long a typical BAA-rated bond. Because of their inverse relationship, the low yields correspond to the high prices and vice versa. The decline in the Northern Pacific 3s in 1940 represented mainly doubts as to the safety of the issue. It is extraordinary that the price recovered to an all-time high in the next few years, and then lost two-thirds of its price chiefly because of the rise in general interest rates. There have been startling variations as well in the price of even the highest grade bonds in the past 40 years. Note that bond prices do not fluctuate in the same inverse proportion as the calculated yields, because their fixed maturity value of 100% exerts a moderating influence. However, for very long maturities, as in our Northern Pacific example, prices and yields change at close to the same rate. Since 1964, record movements in both directions have taken place in the high-grade bond market. Taking prime municipals, tax-free, as an example, their yield more than doubled from 3.2% in January 1965 to 7% in June 1970. Their price index declined, correspondingly, from 110.8 to 67.5. In mid-1970, the yields on high-grade long-term bonds were higher than at any time in the nearly 200 years of this country's economic history. 25 years earlier, just before our protracted bull market began, bond yields were at their lowest point in history. Long-term municipals returned as little as 1%, and industrials gave 2.4%, compared with the 4.5% to 5% formerly considered normal. Those of us with a long experience on Wall Street had seen Newton's law of action and reaction, equal and opposite, work itself out repeatedly in the stock market. The most noteworthy example being the rise in the DJIA from 64 in 1921 to 381 in 1929, followed by a record collapse to 41 in 1932. But this time the widest pendulum swings took place in the usually staid and slow-moving array of high-grade bond prices and yields. Moral? Nothing important on Wall Street can be counted on to occur exactly in the same way as it happened before. This represents the first half of our favorite dictum. The more it changes, the more it's the same thing. If it is virtually impossible to make worthwhile predictions about the price movements of stocks, it is completely impossible to do so for bonds. In the old days, at least, one could often find a useful clue to the coming end of a bull or bear market by studying the prior action of bonds. But no similar clues were given to a coming change in interest rates and bond prices. Hence, the investor must choose between long-term and short-term bond investments on the basis chiefly of his personal preferences. If he wants to be certain that the market values will not decrease, his best choices are probably U.S. savings bonds, Series E or H, which were described before. Either issue will give him a 5% yield after the first year, the Series E for up to 5 5/6 years, the Series H for up to 10 years, with a guaranteed resale value of cost or better. If the investor wants the 7.5% now available on good long-term corporate bonds, or the 5.3% on tax-free municipals, he must be prepared to see them fluctuate in price. Banks and insurance companies have the privilege of valuing high-rated bonds of this type on the mathematical basis of amortized cost, which disregards market prices. It would not be a bad idea for the individual investor to do something similar. The price fluctuations of convertible bonds and preferred stocks are the resultant of three different factors. 1. Variations in the price of the related common stock. 2. Variations in the credit standing of the company. And 3. Variations in general interest rates. A good many of the convertible issues have been sold by companies that have credit ratings well below the best. Some of these were badly affected by the financial squeeze in 1970. As a result, convertible issues as a whole have been subjected to triply unsettling influences in recent years. The price variations have been unusually wide. In the typical case, therefore, the investor would delude himself if he expected to find in convertible issues that ideal combination of the safety of a high-grade bond and price protection, plus a chance to benefit from an advance in the price of the common. This may be a good place to make a suggestion about the long-term bond of the future. Why should not the effects of changing interest rates be divided on some practical and equitable basis between the borrower and the lender? One possibility would be to sell long-term bonds with interest payments that vary with an appropriate index of the going rate. The main results of such an arrangement would be: 1. The investor's bond would always have a principal value of about 100, if the company maintains its credit rating, but the interest received will vary, say, with the rate offered on conventional new issues. 2. The corporation would have the advantages of long-term debt, being spared problems and costs of frequent renewals of refinancing, but its interest costs would change from year to year. Over the past decade, the bond investor has been confronted by an increasingly serious dilemma. Shall he choose complete stability of principal value, but with varying and usually low short-term interest rates? Or shall he choose a fixed interest income with considerable variations, usually downward, it seems, in his principal value? It would be good for most investors if they could compromise between these extremes and be assured that neither their interest return nor their principal value will fall below a stated minimum over, say, a 20-year period. This could be arranged without great difficulty in an appropriate bond contract of a new form. Important note, in effect, the U.S. government has done a similar thing in its combination of the original savings bonds contracts with their extensions at higher interest rates. The suggestion we make here would cover a longer fixed investment period than the savings bonds, and would introduce more flexibility in the interest rate provisions. It is hardly worthwhile to talk about non-convertible preferred stocks, since their special tax status makes the safe ones much more desirable holdings by corporations, for example insurance companies, than by individuals. The poorer quality ones almost always fluctuate over a wide range, percentage-wise, not too differently from common stocks. We can offer no other useful remark about them. Table 16.2 on the enhancement gives some information on the price changes of lower-grade non-convertible preferreds between December 1968 and December 1970. The average decline was 17%, against 11.3% for the S&P Composite Index of Common Stocks.
Commentary on Chapter 8. The happiness of those who want to be popular depends on others. The happiness of those who seek pleasure fluctuates with moods outside their control. But the happiness of the wise grows out of their own free acts. Marcus Aurelius. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Market. Most of the time, the market is mostly accurate in pricing most stocks. Millions of buyers and sellers haggling over price do a remarkably good job of valuing companies, on average. But sometimes, the price is not right. Occasionally, it is very wrong indeed. And at such times, you need to understand Graham's image of Mr. Market. Probably the most brilliant metaphor ever created for explaining how stocks can become mispriced. The manic-depressive Mr. Market does not always price stocks the way an appraiser or a private buyer would value a business. Instead, when stocks are going up, he happily pays more than their objective value. And when they're going down, he's desperate to dump them for less than their true worth. Is Mr. Market still around?
Is he still bipolar?
You bet he is. On March 17, 2000, the stock of Inktomi Corporation hit a new high of $231.63. Since they first came on the market in June 1998, shares in the internet searching software company had gained roughly 1,900%. Just in the few weeks since December 1999, the stock had nearly tripled. What was going on at Inktomi the business that could make Inktomi the stock so valuable? The answer seems obvious. Phenomenally fast growth. In the 3 months ending in December 1999, Inktomi sold $36 million in products and services, more than it had in the entire year ending in December 1998. If Inktomi could sustain its growth rate of the previous 12 months for just 5 more years, its revenues would explode from $36 million a quarter to $5 billion a month. With such growth in sight, the faster the stock went up, the farther up it seemed certain to go. But in his wild love affair with Inktomi's stock, Mr. Market was overlooking something about its business. The company was losing money. Lots of it. It had lost $6 million in the most recent quarter, $24 million in the 12 months before that, and $24 million in the year before that. In its entire corporate lifetime, Inktomi had never made a dime in profits. Yet on March 17, 2000, Mr. Market valued this tiny business at a total of $25 billion. Yes, that's billion with a B. And then Mr. Market went into a sudden nightmarish depression. On September 30th, 2002, just 2.5 years after hitting $231.62 per share, Inktomi's stock closed at 25 cents, collapsing from a total market value of $25 billion to less than $40 million. Had Inktomi's business dried up? Not at all. Over the previous 12 months, the company had generated $113 million in revenues. So what had changed? Only Mr. Market's mood. In early 2000, investors were so wild about the internet that they priced Inktomi shares at 250 times the company's revenues. Now, however, they would pay only 0.35 times its revenues. Mr. Market had morphed from Dr. Jekyll to Mr. Hyde and was ferociously trashing every stock that had made a fool out of him. But Mr. Market was no more justified in his midnight rage than he had been in his manic euphoria. On December 23, 2002, Yahoo Incorporated announced that it would buy Inktomi for $1.65 per share. That was nearly 7 times Inktomi's stock price on September 30th. History will probably show that Yahoo got a bargain. When Mr. Market makes stocks so cheap, it's no wonder that entire companies get bought right out from under him. Think for yourself. Would you willingly allow a certifiable lunatic to come by at least 5 times a week to tell you that you should feel exactly the way he feels? Would you ever agree to be euphoric just because he is, or miserable just because he thinks you should be? Of course not. You'd insist on your right to take control of your own emotional life, based on your experiences and your beliefs. But when it comes to their financial lives, millions of people let Mr. Market tell them how to feel and what to do, despite the obvious fact that from time to time, he can get nuttier than a fruitcake. In 1999, when Mr. Market was squealing with delight, American employees directed an average of 8.6% of their paychecks into their 401k retirement plans. By 2002, after Mr. Market had spent 3 years stuffing stocks into black garbage bags, the average contribution rate had dropped by nearly one quarter to just 7%. The cheaper stocks got, the less eager people became to buy them, because they were imitating Mr. Market instead of thinking for themselves. The intelligent investor shouldn't ignore Mr. Market entirely. Instead, you should do business with him, but only to the extent that it serves your interests. Mr. Market's job is to provide you with prices. Your job is to decide whether it is to your advantage to act on them. You do not have to trade with him just because he constantly begs you to. By refusing to let Mr. Market be your master, you transform him into your servant. After all, even when he seems to be destroying values, he is creating them elsewhere. In 1999, the Wilshire 5000 Index, the broadest measure of U.S. stock performance, gained 23.8%, powered by technology and telecommunication stocks. But 3,743 of the 7,234 stocks in the Wilshire Index went down in value, even as the average was rising. While those high-tech and telecom stocks were hotter than the hood of a race car on an August afternoon, thousands of old economy shares were frozen in the mud, getting cheaper and cheaper. The stock of CMGI, an incubator or holding company for internet startup firms, went up an astonishing 939.9% in 1999. Meanwhile, Berkshire Hathaway, the holding company through which Graham's greatest disciple, Warren Buffett, owns such old economy stalwarts as Coca-Cola, Gillette, and the Washington Post Company, dropped by 24.9%. But then, as it so often does, the market had a sudden mood swing. Figure 8.1, which can be found on the enhancement, offers a sampling of how the stinkers of 1999 became the stars of 2000 through 2002. As for those two holding companies, CMGI went on to lose 96% in 2000, another 70.9% in 2001, and still 39.8% more in 2002. A cumulative loss of 99.3%. Berkshire Hathaway went up 26.6% in 2000 and 6.5% in 2001. Then had a slight 3.8% loss in 2002, a cumulative gain of 30%. Can you beat the pros at their own game? One of Graham's most powerful insights is this: the investor who permits himself to be stampeded or unduly worried by unjustified market declines in his holdings is perversely transforming his basic advantage into a basic disadvantage. What does Graham mean by those words, basic advantage? He means that the intelligent individual investor has the full freedom to choose whether or not to follow Mr. Market. You have the luxury of being able to think for yourself. The typical money manager, however, has no choice but to mimic Mr. Market's every move. Buying high, selling low, marching almost mindlessly in his erratic footsteps. Here are some of the handicaps mutual fund managers and other professional investors are saddled with. With billions of dollars under management, they must gravitate toward the biggest stocks, the only ones they can buy in the multi-million dollar quantities they need to fill their portfolios. Thus, many funds end up owning the same few overpriced giants. Investors tend to pour more money into funds as the market rises. The managers use that new cash to buy more of the stocks they already own, driving prices to even more dangerous heights. If fund investors ask for their money back when the market drops, the managers may need to sell stocks to cash them out. Just as the funds are forced to buy stocks at inflated prices in a rising market, they become forced sellers as stocks get cheap again. Many portfolio managers get bonuses for beating the market, so they obsessively measure their returns against benchmarks like the S&P 500 index. If a company gets added to an index, hundreds of funds compulsively buy it. If they don't and that stock then does well, the managers look foolish. On the other hand, if they buy it and it does poorly, no one will blame them. Increasingly, fund managers are expected to specialize. Just as in medicine, the general practitioner has given way to the pediatric allergist and the geriatric otolaryngologist, fund managers must buy only small growth stocks, or only mid-sized value stocks, or nothing but large blend stocks. If a company gets too big, or too small, or too cheap, or an itty bit too expensive, the fund has to sell it, even if the manager loves the stock. So there's no reason you can't do as well as the pros. What you cannot do, despite all the pundits who say you can, is to beat the pros at their own game. The pros can't even win their own game. Why should you want to play it at all? If you follow their rules, you will lose, since you'll end up as much a slave to Mr. Market as the professionals are. Instead, recognize that investing intelligently is about controlling the controllable. You can't control whether the stocks or funds you buy will outperform the market today, next week, this month, or this year. In the short run, your returns will always be hostage to Mr. Market and his whims. But you can control your brokerage costs by trading rarely, patiently, and cheaply. Your ownership costs by refusing to buy mutual funds with excessive annual expenses. Your expectations by using realism, not fantasy, to forecast your returns. Your risk by deciding how much of your total assets to put at hazard in the stock market, by diversifying and by rebalancing. Your tax bills by holding stocks for at least 1 year, and whenever possible for at least 5 years, to lower your capital gains liability. And, most of all, your own behavior. If you listen to financial TV or read most market columnists, you'd think that investing is some kind of sport, or a war, or a struggle for survival in a hostile wilderness. But investing isn't about beating others at their game, it's about controlling yourself at your own game. The challenge for the intelligent investor is not to find the stocks that will go up the most and down the least, but rather to prevent yourself from being your own worst enemy, from buying high just because Mr. Market says, buy, and from selling low just because Mr. Market says, sell. If your investment horizon is long, at least 25 or 30 years, there's only one sensible approach. Buy every month, automatically, and whenever else you can spare some money. The single best choice for this lifelong holding is a total stock market index fund. Sell only when you need the cash. For a psychological boost, clip out and sign your investment owner's contract, which you can find on page 225. To be an intelligent investor, you must also refuse to judge your financial success by how a bunch of total strangers are doing. You're not one penny poorer if someone in Dubuque or Dallas or Denver beats the S&P 500 and you don't. No one's gravestone reads, "He beat the market." I once interviewed a group of retirees in Boca Raton, one of Florida's wealthiest retirement communities. I asked these people, mostly in their 70s, if they had beaten the market over their investing lifetimes. Some said yes, some said no, most weren't sure. Then one man said, "Who cares? All I know is my investments earn me enough to end up in Boca." Could there be a more perfect answer? After all, the whole point of investing is not to earn more money than average, but to earn enough money to meet your own needs. The best way to measure your investing success is not by whether you're beating the market, but by whether you've put in place a financial plan and a behavioral discipline that are likely to get you where you want to go. In the end, what matters isn't crossing the finish line before anybody else, but just making sure that you do cross it. Your money and your brain. Why then do investors find Mr. Market so seductive?
It turns out that our brains are hardwired to get us into investing trouble. Humans are pattern-seeking animals. Psychologists have shown that if you present people with a random sequence and tell them that it's unpredictable, they will nevertheless insist on trying to guess what's coming next. Likewise, we know that the next roll of the dice will be a 7, that a baseball player is due for a base hit, that the next winning number in the Powerball lottery will definitely be 4, 27, 9, 16, 42, 10. And that this hot little stock is the next Microsoft. Groundbreaking new research in neuroscience shows that our brains are designed to perceive trends even where they might not exist. After an event occurs just 2 or 3 times in a row, regions of the human brain called the anterior cingulate and nucleus accumbens automatically anticipate that it will happen again. If it does repeat, a natural chemical called dopamine is released, flooding your brain with a soft euphoria. Thus, if a stock goes up a few times in a row, you reflexively expect it to keep going. And your brain chemistry changes as the stock rises, giving you a natural high. You effectively become addicted to your own predictions. But when stocks drop, that financial loss fires up your amygdala, the part of the brain that processes fear and anxiety and generates the famous fight-or-flight response that is common to all cornered animals. Just as you can't keep your heart rate from rising if a fire alarm goes off, just as you can't avoid flinching if a rattlesnake slithers onto your hiking path, you can't help feeling fearful when stock prices are plunging. In fact, the brilliant psychologists Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky have shown that the pain of financial loss is more than twice as intense as the pleasure of an equivalent gain. Making $1,000 on a stock feels great, but a $1,000 loss wields an emotional wallop more than twice as powerful. Losing money is so painful that many people, terrified at the prospect of any further loss, sell out near the bottom or refuse to buy more. That helps explain why we fixate on the raw magnitude of a market decline and forget to put the loss in proportion. So if a TV reporter hollers, "The market is plunging! The Dow is down 100 points!" most people instinctively shudder. But at the Dow's recent level of 8,000, that's a drop of just 1.2%. Now think how ridiculous it would sound if on a day when it's 81 degrees outside, the TV weatherman shrieked, "The temperature is plunging! It's dropped from 81 degrees to 80 degrees! That too is a 1.2% drop. When you forget to view changing market prices in percentage terms, it's all too easy to panic over minor vibrations. If you have decades of investing ahead of you, there's a better way to visualize the financial news broadcasts. See the sidebar on page 222. In the late 1990s, many people came to feel that they were in the dark unless they checked the prices of their stocks several times a day. But as Graham puts it, the typical investor would be better off if his stocks had no market quotation at all, for he would then be spared the mental anguish caused him by other persons' mistakes of judgment. If after checking the value of your stock portfolio at 1:24 p.m., you feel compelled to check it all over again at 1:37 p.m., ask yourself these questions. Did I call a real estate agent to check the market price of my house at 1:24 p.m.? Did I call back at 1:37 p.m.? If I had, would the price have changed? If it did, would I have rushed to sell my house? By not checking, or even knowing, the market price of my house from minute to minute, do I prevent its value from rising over time? The only possible answer to these questions is of course not. And you should view your portfolio the same way. Over a 10 or 20 or 30 year investment horizon, Mr. Market's daily dipsy doodles simply do not matter. In any case, for anyone who will be investing for years to come, Falling stock prices are good news, not bad, since they enable you to buy more for less money. The longer and further stocks fall, and the more steadily you keep buying as they